Today we welcome Mary Turner-Thompson, an author from Edinburgh. She has written a book called The Bigamist, which, Emma, I think you've read and I've also read. Don't know about you, Emma, but I could not put it down. I read it in about 7 hours.
Yeah, I can actually believe it was a real story, to be honest. So I've told lots of people about it. I think they're kind of on the same lines as me, that it's just one of those stories that if you didn't know someone who it happened to, it would seem like it should be a film, really.
Absolutely. I just couldn't put it down. So welcome, Mary Turner-Thompson, and thank you so much for being here with us tonight.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
So, Mary, do you want to just tell us a little bit about your book and just give our listeners, because obviously we're a true crime podcast, so a lot of the time on the episodes that we publish on the podcast, we'll talk about other podcasts that we're listening to, documentaries we're watching, and books we're reading. Your book obviously came up between Emma and I, so it's an absolute honour to have you. And yeah, if you could just tell us a little bit about your book.
Oh gosh, where do I start? Well, I met a man online dating in the year 2000, when online dating was brand new. And one of my friends turned around and said, why don't you try this newfangled thing? You're a single mother, you know, you've got 30s and you've got a one-year-old child, you know, what could possibly go wrong?
If only they knew.
Yes. So, so you never realise those words will come back to haunt you, will you? And yeah, it basically, I met this lovely man, married him, had two children with him, which was miraculous because he told me he was infertile and couldn't have children. But somehow between the union between us, we managed to actually conceive. And things were a little bit fraught because he worked as an intelligence officer for the Official Department of Central Intelligence, more commonly known as the CIA. And as life got more and more fraught and dangerous and uncomfortable, I eventually discovered that he wasn't actually a CIA agent and he wasn't actually who he said he was at all. And more importantly, he wasn't actually my husband. He was actually somebody else's husband. So I got a phone call from my husband's other wife on the 5th of April, 2006. And she rang me and said that not only did she think that I was another agent, but he was certainly not infertile because she had five children to him. The nanny had two children to him. He certainly had at least one other child in America. And it turns out the man is not only a bigamist, he's also a psychopath and a con man who actively impregnates women to rip them off for money. And he ripped me off for just short of £200,000, left me with two children and pretty much homeless. So I had to start again from scratch. Oh, and he also took credit cards out of my name to the tune of £56,000. So I wasn't even starting from scratch. I was starting from minus £56,000. So I sort of built myself back up from there. But that's a sort of short summary of what the book's about.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's certainly obviously a lot more detail and a lot of interesting points in the book. So you met him in 2000, you know, you were venturing into the world of online dating. Can I ask, the friend that suggested you do this, are you still friends with them?
Yes, I am. I mean, it's like it's one of those weird things. At the beginning of online dating, you know, there was people going, oh, well, you don't know. And, you know, you thought that people could lie, but you didn't think that they would go as far as he did. You know, you just assumed that, yeah, they might lie. I mean, I actually did date when I was doing the online dating. I actually met a guy who said he was 6'4". And I'm 5'10", so, you know, there are not that many guys to date that are taller than me. So I went to this date and I arrived about 10 minutes early. And to my astonishment, the guy was already there. So I went in and I sat down and joined him and could see from him sitting down that there was no way he was 6'4". And so I turned around and said, you know, look, you're obviously not 6'4". How tall are you? And he was 5'3". And he put more than a foot onto his height. And when I said, why have you lied? Because that's just an out and out lie. And he said, because I like tall women. And I said, yeah, and I like tall men. You know, go figure. So, you know, you expect people to lie about their weight or their age or their height or something. But you expect a kind of little lie. to shave a few pounds off.
I think lying online, you know, lying online, I get it. I can understand why people do it to kind of secure the first date. You know, you've heard it happening. I don't approve of it, obviously, but it is what it is. It'll happen. Maybe an insecurity or, you know, that kind of thing. I think it's the ongoing in-person lies. I think that's the thing that got me so much about the book was the evidence that he could give you. It was the intricacy. It was the layers and layers of detail. Yes. That was what got me, because you're such an intelligent woman and it's so...
It's so difficult
to see how, you know, anyone could be drawn in by, but then not only you, but there's other equally intelligent women who have been drawn in by this man. It's just gobsmacking, really. Yeah,
he's quite a player. He's not just a bit of a bad lad. I mean, he is an out and out psychopath. I mean, what he does is systematic. It is controlled, it is done. I mean, there's certain things that really surprise people in the book. I mean, certain things like when things get too good and too comfortable and everything's working out and everything's fine, you know, a psychopath, one of the driving forces behind any psychopath is they get very, very bored very, very easily because they don't have a reward structure like we do. They don't get rewarded by being hugged. They don't get rewarded by, you know, having somebody approve of their actions. People who are empathic have massive rewards from just knowing that their mother's proud of them or their children are looking up to them, you know, whereas a psychopath doesn't have that. So the only rewards they have are money, sex and power. So the money he took from me was just a measurement of control. It didn't matter at all. It was just a measurement of whether he was winning or losing the game. So whenever it got too easy, he would make things hard again. Do something dramatic that would actually have to make him grab back control again. So he would do something dramatic, like put the wedding ring on the bed that wasn't mine and wasn't his, so that it would make me question him and, you know, put him on a spot, because it was getting himself out of those spots that was entertaining for him.
Can I just say, when I read that in the book, my heart sank, and I couldn't figure out whether it was a complete mistake or it was deliberate. And I felt like you know, it was just that sort of moment, like, did he mess up? Was this deliberate? And my heart hurt when I read that part in the book. I remember. Do you remember, Emma?
Yeah, it's horrendous. It really does seem to me that he just liked dangling people, really. He just loved that
manipulation
feeling. Yeah, that feeling of just being able to pick you up and drop you, you know, take you to these dizzy heights of love and adoration and just feeling so, so special. And then in the next minute, boom, gone, abandonment for however long. And then when he came back, you were made to feel guilty sometimes that you questioned him, which is just so mind-boggling. Like, I don't think I've ever been so infuriated at someone I don't know just through reading it.
I look back at it and I'm infuriated with myself. One of the worst things and it still is niggling to me now that this happened. And it's not what you think. It's not the money. It's not the fact that he had me living in fear of having my children kidnapped and bits ripped off them and sent to the post. It's not the coercive control. It is, you know, one of the incidents that is actually quite minor in the book, but still niggles me today, is when he said to me that he was home and could I please come and pick him up, because he was in George Street, in one of the buildings in George Street, and could I just come and pick him up? And it was like, yay, you know, daddy's home. So took my three-year-old then and one-year-old and baby daughter and my three-year-old in the car, drove to George Street, which was 20 minutes away, and sat in the car, texted him and said, I'm here. And he said, oh, great, I'll be down in a second. So I sat there and I waited. 5 minutes, 10 minutes went by, and I would text him again going, where are you? I'm sitting here waiting. And he said, oh, sorry, I was just on my way down the stairs. Somebody asked me to do something. I'll be out in a minute. So I sat there and I waited another 5 minutes, another 10 minutes went by again, getting really irritated and annoyed, texting, saying, where are you? This is getting annoying. And he said, oh, I'm really sorry. The person that did it, you know, is just, you know, I will be out. I'm coming. It just, you know, it's delayed. And this went on and on and on. And I've got a baby, luckily, who was asleep at the time, but a three-year-old who I'm feeding biscuits to and trying to entertain for an hour in the car. And, you know, still he's like, I'm on my way, I'm on my way, I'm on. I was there 2 hours. I was there 2 hours before eventually I just went, I'm off, I'm gone, I'm done, and I left. He wasn't even in Edinburgh. He wasn't even in Scotland. He was not here. He was in Manchester. He just wanted to see how long he could make me wait. And that still bugs me, because it's the thing about a psychopath, which is what he is. You don't, they have no emotional response, even to their own children. So making that child wait, you know, so making two babies, a baby and a three-year-old, wait in a car along with mother is irrelevant. It didn't matter if it was going to cause any, you know, it was just how long. That's the game.
Symbolic, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And so it's still to me, that's where I get angry. You invest a certain amount of time. Once you've been there half an hour, you didn't want to just leave because he was on his way out. He's just coming, he's just coming, he's just coming. And, you know, it's sort of like, and how, you know, and eventually, actually, I think after an hour and a half or whatever, he just stopped responding. I mean, I was phoning him every 5 seconds going, where are you? And that kind of slightly fuses my brain and slightly makes me go, it makes me angry that I didn't go 5 minutes in, all right, you're not here, I'm off, and just go.
Do you think then, because I mean, this was going through my head, and maybe it's just me and my personality, leaving the wedding ring, he's made a massive mistake. Do you think it was deliberate then?
I thought at the time it was a mistake. No, I'm absolutely 100% sure it was deliberate. You know, the bed was absolutely pristinely made, which isn't normal, by the way, in my household. Not normal. A good shake of a duvet, you know, that's it, done. But it was absolutely smooth and the wedding ring was on it. So if he had sat down on the bed and it had fallen out of his pocket, then there would have been a dent, or there would have been crinkles in the bedding. But you know, it was absolutely pristine, and the only way that could have happened is if he'd actually placed it very carefully on top.
Did he not also leave the bag as well?
So because he'd left the wedding ring, and I knew that wasn't his because it wasn't the one I gave him in our wedding. And you know, sort of to find a wedding ring on the, I mean, we were on holiday with the family, he'd gone off to a meeting, so me and the children were in the chalet, and I just go into the bedroom for something and see this random wedding ring on our double bed. But he'd also left his bag with all his papers in it, which I was never allowed to go into. So I went into the bag. But that was the reason for the wedding ring being there, so that I would break the rules of our relationship and just defy his trust by going into the bag. And of course, what I found was quite extraordinary.
I think you're right, though. It sounds like for him, you know, everything was going so well for you. You're on this holiday, it's idyllic, you've got him there. You must have got your hopes up every time that kind of thing happened. And then he's just got to dash them again and just break you down that a little bit more.
It was absolute brainwashing. I mean, what he did was brainwashing. What he did was coercive control. I mean, at the time, there were no laws against coercive control. It wasn't even considered domestic abuse. The new book, which it's hard to talk about one in isolation, because the new book is called The Psychopath. And actually what I've been doing in The Psychopath and the new book is actually breaking down how and what they do to coercively control people. So I've been really researching the language used and the techniques and how to emotionally manipulate people. And it's about constantly having that carrot in front of you, that things are going to get better. So he was always just about to come home. Things were always just about to get better. Just like the example I gave in George Street, he was just on his way. He was just about to arrive. He was just around the corner. He was tying his shoelace. Everything was just delay it one more minute, one more second. And once you invested all that time, you didn't want to throw it all away. It's like a gambler finding the last pound. You don't go, well, I've now got a pound, I'm going home. You go, well, I've lost everything except this one pound. I might as well try and win it back with this pound. You know, it is hypnotic. It is immersive. It is addictive, the way they treat people and the way they do it. And it's very, very, very clever. But once you know what's happening, once you understand the principles and how they do it, that's how you protect yourself, which is why I have written the second book, which is, as I say, breaks it down much further into how he was doing it and what he was doing and how I was the victim of it.
I think that's really, really good, because personally, I wish that I had read a book on how to identify coercive control and these kind of things when I was younger. And certainly, I think that would be valuable reading for anyone, really. Emma was saying at the start, you're a very intelligent person. You've got your wits about you. And the truth is that it can happen to anyone. It doesn't matter whether you've got a low IQ or a high IQ, whether you're well-educated or not. If it's not something that you're well-versed with, so for example, if you're not a psychopath yourself and you don't understand these things, if you're like what I'd like to think most people are, empathetic and kind and caring as most people are, you're always going to be vulnerable to these types of people. And the way that I see it is almost like predators and prey. He was a predator and he knew exactly what he was looking for in his prey. And it's almost like they identify your traits and they measure you up to find out. And it's these little tests, you know, these little things that they'll do to just see what your reaction is and see how you respond and see if you'll stick around, so that they can just see how far they can push you. It's almost like they're assessing whether you're suitable prey for them.
Absolutely. That's exactly what they do. One thing that really shook me when I was writing The Psychopath is that when I was writing The Bigamist, I found out all about the psychopath test. I don't know if you've heard about the psychopath test. So that there's a 20-question questionnaire, which is 0, 1, or 2. And the statements like grandiose sense of self-worth. And if you score, if you are definitely that, it would be 2. If you might be a little bit, you're 1. If you're definitely not, you'd be 0. So there's a maximum score of 40 out of 40. Now, myself, once I knew the truth, I did the psychopath test on Will Jordan and he gets 40 out of 40, including things like many marital relationships and criminal versatility and juvenile delinquency and, you know, et cetera. So you get 40 out of 40. And I learned all about that and that test and psychopaths from The Bigamist. What I learned from writing The Psychopath is that there is a scale of empathy the same way as there is a scale of psychopathy. You don't realize quite how much it is. I assumed everybody who was empathic was just as empathic as I am, but actually they're not. I score extremely highly on the empathy scale. So as a result, you find that a high scoring psychopath will target a high scoring empath. And what happens is a psychopath, just as you said, when they're first targeting somebody, they will do something, they will test the waters. They will see whether or not the person will bite. And they'll say something like, I'm infertile, I can't have children. And then if the other person turns around and goes, oh, bad luck with that, see you later, that's not going to be a target, because that person didn't have empathy for that situation. Whereas the person who is highly empathic, who would turn around and say, oh, dear, dear, bad luck, you know, what can we do to help you? That person becomes a target. So I think it's quite funny also when people are reviewing my book, and this sounds so arrogant and I'm sorry, but it's just, it's funny. The ones that review my book and say, oh, nobody would ever believe that, it's absolute rubbish and things like that, those aren't the people who would ever get caught, because they're not empathic. Yeah. They're the ones that are, you know, on the other side of the scale. So they're not psychopaths, but they're not empaths either. There's a lot of people in the middle ground.
I think you're speaking to two highly empathic people, because we've both been in nothing remotely near what you've been through, but been in relationships where we've been gaslit and been under coercive control. And I completely can see how it happened to you. I've been there, not in the same way, but I guess it's just, I was lucky not to encounter someone as psychopathic as him. I mean, it's just horrific. The thing that I find quite interesting, looking back at the situation, I'm sure that in a way for you being able to rationalize and knowing the science behind it. So I'm a psychology graduate and I know a bit about these kind of things as well. And I just, for me, I always find it really interesting to read up on it. And it never takes the pain away, but it does kind of let you understand what's happened to you. Yeah. Would you say that that's how it's happened for you?
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, I think you can probably tell by the way I'm talking, I don't have any emotional residue left. There's very little that kind of triggers me at all with regard to this situation, because it's, as you said before, it's predators and prey. They are like cats playing with mice. And as a result, it is not personal. It's nothing to do with the victim, and no more than the mouse being, whether it's a pretty mouse or a rich mouse or a happy mouse or a mouse with babies, it is nothing to do with it. It's just a toy. It's just a plaything that the predator goes, I'll have that. And as a result, it isn't personal. What I've looked at, you know, with the psychopath and realizing what I allowed him to do to me rather than the other way around was because I am empathic, because I am highly empathic, and because he played on that. But I don't think that's a bad thing to be. I would rather be empathic and connected, because I feel connected to people like yourselves who are empathic as well. And that reward we get is everything to me. The reward you get from the love of your children and for the love of your friends and everything else, that psychopaths don't have. And I actually, in that way, I feel sorry for them. Still, I would advise anybody anywhere near anyone who's toxic or psychopathic to drop them like a hot book and run away as fast as you can and go no contact, because that's the only way you can actually deal with it. Nobody who has got no empathy is not going to ever get empathy. But being aware is absolutely 100% what it matters. You know, being aware of what they do and how they do it is the key to protecting yourself and becoming a victim to them.
I agree. It's funny. I've heard friends that have been in toxic situations who've been with people that have certainly shown psychopathic tendencies. And I've heard the phrase, it's my fault, I'm too trusting. And I just don't agree with that at all. I would hate to go through life being cynical and put up these walls and shut people out. I would much rather be trusting and allow people to come into my life. And I just think that, to me, it's not right. It's not your fault. You can't say, well, I allowed a psychopath to come into my life. It's all my fault. It's just not how it works.
I mean, at the end of the day, that's the last thing they can take from you. And if they can't take that from you, if they can't tread down that very last part of your nature that unfortunately did make you prey to it in the first place, then they've not won, really.
No, they haven't. Exactly. But I mean, you cannot live without trust. You can't survive on this planet without trusting other people. I mean, you can't get into a taxi and insist that the taxi driver gives you his license. And so you can look up the license. You'd then have to actually call the DVLA and make sure that the license is actually genuine. You'd then have to find out who the person at DVLA is, so that you could actually get their references and what allowed them to get that job. And then you'd have to, you know, if you have no trust, you know, you have to trust when you get into a taxi that the guy knows how to drive. You have to trust when you go to the doctor that the doctor actually has a medical degree and knows what he's doing. You have to trust as you walk down the street that the cars that are driving on the road are going to abide by the laws of the road and are not going to drive onto the pavement and hit you. Mm. You know, you cannot survive without trusting people. So those that say, oh, you know, that I'm cynical, I don't trust anyone, it's absolute nonsense. Of course they do. They've got a level of trust. They don't go above, but, you know, they do trust people.
You also tend to believe that people that you interact with and kind of form relationships with have the same moral compass as yourself. So that's something. And obviously he was really good at mimicking a normal person all the way through.
Even more, not much more moral than I was. You know, there were things that he was, you know, that he wouldn't have actually allowed that I would.
Just going back to what you were saying earlier about the psychopathy test, it's funny that you should bring that up, because I was in a relationship with, I'm a little bit uncertain about the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath. I sometimes read different descriptions of them and I wonder if they're one and the same or they're are very different things. But I refer to him as a psychopath. And when we were coming to the end of our relationship, you know, I very quickly realised that I'd made a mistake. We were living together at the time and I thought, you know, I need to get out of this, because just similar things, very like coercive, controlling, manipulative, that kind of thing. And there was actually a program on telly that night, and it was about psychopaths. And, it, you know, I can't remember exactly what the program was called, but in it, they mentioned the psychopath test. And we were sort of having a bit of a laugh, and he was sitting at the computer at the time in the living room. And I said, oh, I didn't realize such a thing existed. And he went on it and he took the test. And it was either in the high 80s or low 90s% that he scored. And I looked at him, and I mean, by this point, I knew that he was. And I said, that's really concerning. And he like laughed, like he found it obviously hilarious. And I remember speaking to my sister about it, and she said, well, there's also, I can't remember the name of it, but she said, there's also this theory that when people are completing answers to something, they'll also slightly answer in the way that they think the test wants them to answer in. And they said, she said, taking that into account, he probably would have actually scored higher than that, because he would have answered some questions in a way that he probably thought the test would want him to answer. And I thought, after the relationship was over, I thought, no wonder you scored so highly on that bloody test, because you are a psychopath completely and utterly.
It is extraordinary how effective that test is. But I mean, if I'd done that test on Will Jordan when I was with him, before I knew the truth, I would have given him zero. You know, I would have given him nothing. I know the program you're talking about.
I was on Channel 4.
Yeah, sort of like, and there was a big online test that went with it. Yes, that was it was fascinating, actually. But to go back to something you said, the difference between sociopaths and psychopaths, I can tell you the difference.
Excellent.
So used to be 10 years, 15 years ago, that actually it was almost polar opposite. All right. But currently the situation is, so I called Will Jordan a sociopath in the book The Bigamist, but actually in the new version that's coming out in September, he will be called a psychopath, because it's changed. The difference between psychopaths and sociopaths is that a psychopath is born with no conscience, remorse, or chemical empathic response to other people's pain. So there's about two points in your brain, just above the ears towards the back, where if I snap my finger in front of you, you'd wince, your eyes would crinkle, your head would go back, because it's rather like two needles going into your skull. And you feel the actual physical pain when you see somebody else in pain. So psychopaths are born without that. So they grow up mimicking what other people are doing, but without any empathic response, with no guilt, no remorse, or anything else. Sociopaths, on the other hand, are born with chemical empathic response, but due to severe childhood abuse or lack of empathy, they don't learn to use it. So because it is up to the age of 5, because they don't have love in their life, because they don't have a loving parent, because they're not showed affection and things like that, their empathy is therefore quashed. And it, once it's quashed, it's gone. So after the age of 5, growing up, they are essentially the same thing.
I see, because I'd read a description which I thought was accurate, but it could be outdated. And the distinction between the two, one seemed to say, and I believe it was psychopaths, it explained that psychopaths could react emotionally, i.e. out of anger or embarrassment, they could have a snap reaction, whereas sociopaths were very level, you know, it was all very engines running, but there's nothing no behind the wheel kind of thing. And that's what I thought the difference was. But
that's old fashioned. Outdated. I mean, what's happening now is, because of the confusion between psychopath, sociopath, narcissist, malignant, sadist, all the different issues, they're actually trying to now funnel it right down and just use the word psychopath. Mm. So, you know, there are very clear distinctions between a malignant narcissist and a psychopath, but there's not any reason for us to actually distinguish between psychopath and sociopath. And all those terms actually are layman's terms. Mm. The Diagnostic Statistical Manual, DSM-5, that actually classes them all as antisocial personality disorder.
Right.
So, you know, the term psychopath, sociopath, narcissist, they are all layman's terms that we use to describe different aspects of antisocial personality disorder.
I read quite an interesting article about narcissism, because that's kind of how I would have classified my ex. And it said that they're usually quite happy to identify as a narcissist. And I remember said something along the lines of, God, you really love yourself, don't you? You really think you are something else. And he's like, well, not been proved wrong so far.
Wow.
And he, oh God, it's just that smug smile. You know, face you'd never get tired of punching, one of those.
it sounds delightful, Emma.
Yeah, I'm not with him anymore, so unsurprisingly.
I actually have a question for you, Mary, and I don't know what your thought is on this, but this was something that I was thinking about, and I think Emma and I might have had a conversation about this recently. One of the things that struck me in the book, which I thought was quite interesting, was obviously I don't want to give too much away, but there was mention of an accidental recording where you essentially said it sounded like you were listening to a different person. Now, I identified with that when I was reading it in the book because the ex that I had, who was a psychopath, he had a young daughter when we met, and often I would go to pick her up alone. And so her mum and I got on really well, and we were on good terms, and, you know, we were friendly. And because I had such a strong relationship with his daughter, after our relationship ended, my relationship with his daughter continued because we had a really strong bond. And my friendship with her mum then just increased because obviously we were no longer together. And obviously after breaking up, we compared notes about, you know, our relationships. And we found that actually his responses to both of us were very, very different. Now, for example, with his daughter's mum, he was quite derogatory and belittling, which, don't get me wrong, there was instances of that in our relationship as well. But in our relationship, he would do things like he would cook dinner for us. You know, he would rub my shoulders. He would give me foot massages. He would do quite sweet things. You know, he's quite good at apologising and things like that. And I remember when we compared notes, she said, oh, I never got anything like that. It was very, very different for me. And when I read the bit in your book about the accidental recording, it made me wonder if, you know, I know that psychopaths, because they don't have these emotions themselves, that it's very much mimicked. It's mimicked behaviour. And I wondered if they almost just mirror the person that they're actually mimicking. And that's why their behaviour is different between the relationship that I had with him and the relationship he had with someone else. And that's what it sounded like also from that part in the book with you and the other person.
Yeah, it's partly mirroring, but it goes beyond that.
Right.
So when a psychopath, when they are young, so I'll give you an example. It's sort of like when any of us were 18 and going out to a pub and rather like the look of somebody else and might go up and flirt with them, and they turn around and look at us with complete disdain and say, get lost. Right. We would probably not only go back to the bar, but go out the door, home, lick our wounds, probably never again approach somebody, or at least not for a month, a day, a week, a year, something, you know, because we would be so crushed by that rejection. A psychopath doesn't have that crushed feeling. They don't have that. So they'll walk up to somebody and say, hey babe, you know, etc. And the girl will tell him to get lost, and he'll go immediately to the next one, and to the next one, to the next one. So he'll do 100 in one night. And each time he's learning not only what works as a fisherman, net fisherman, but what works as a line fisherman. So what works with that kind of personality, what works with that kind of personality, so he, by the end of, you know, 10 years of doing this, knows exactly how to approach every different personality. There's actually research done on, again, this is talking about the psychopath, the book, rather than the bigamist, but there's research done showing that psychopaths who are criminally identified in jail, who have done research on them, can identify a particular person to mug by the way they walk. So how you walk, your body language, they know exactly who would be the right person to mug. And the same applies, you know, because they are so articulate in their body language observations because of this constant practice. This is why they come across as so charming, because every time they meet someone, they're giving that person exactly what they want, because they know more than you do what will work. So in my case, for instance, Will Jordan never raised his voice. Never once did he get angry. I tell a lie. When the police phoned me and he found out I'd said that my husband was driving my car, he got angry then, but on the phone. But that's the only ever time he got angry in our 6-year relationship. But he, in other relationships, he'd had them up against the wall by the throat. If he had raised his voice to me, we'd have been out the door, you know, let alone raised a hand to me, because that's a deal breaker. And he knew that. But, you know, so he will have, your ex will have known what you would and would not accept. And he will have known what the mother of his child would and would not accept. And they're chameleons. So they just become, yes, morph into that,
yes,
perfect being.
Chameleon is a word I often use to describe psychopaths. Yeah. It is. They blend into the surroundings. It's
We're taught from early childhood that, you know, one day we're going to meet the one. You know, we're going to meet the romantic person. I absolutely cannot stand rom-coms now. All right, I can't cope with them because I watch them and just go, it's a load of nonsense.
You can swear on this podcast, by the way.
It's a load of bollocks. And like, just whenever I'm watching my daughter going, it's like, that is complete no. It's all very lovely and great, but I actually really like when we come across a movie where, like, he seems like Mr. Right and everything else, and then she just, you know, she goes, I would love it if Pretty Woman, and, you know, he came up in his limo waving his umbrella and all the rest of it, and she turned around and go, no thanks, I'm going to college, you know. I love those kind of movies. But the whole thing we're brought up with, which is, you know, you're going to find the right one, you're going to find the perfect match. And the trouble is, the only person who is going to be the perfect match is the one that is totally catering to you and becoming chameleon-like, the person that you want them to be. And that person is going to be a psychopath. And I know it's not with everybody, but that's where that danger is. You find that Mr. Right, and he's just so, so Mr. Wrong.
I don't believe in soulmates at all. I believe in compatibility, and that there are various people throughout your life that you'll meet that you can be very compatible with. Yeah. And I'm sure that you agree with me that it is a case where you have to adapt and you have to put up with each other's flaws. And I think the problem is with people who are empathic like us is that sometimes you can put up with too much because you hear the sob story and you feel for them, and it's softly, isn't it? It's, oh well, he's gone through this terrible thing, that's really a shame, I feel terrible for him. I've not really been through perhaps as awful an experience, so I'll kind of put myself to one side and I'll put up with more than I normally would do. So I think it can be really, really difficult. I think it's a complete minefield. One of the things that we were interested in asking you was if you could describe for us, and for maybe the listeners that don't know much about it, about gaslighting and any kind of tips that you have surrounding how to recognize gaslighting in a relationship.
Certainly. I think start with love bombing, because when you first get into a relationship with somebody, love bombing happens naturally. So it happens in a normal relationship where everything is absolutely wonderful, it's rose-tinted glasses, etc. But with a psychopathic or toxic relationship with a narcissist or anything else, they love bomb you, and they it's overwhelming. You know, you feel like you're being dragged through the relationship a little bit faster than you'd be comfortable with. And that's the point, is to get you off balance. And, you know, you'll be getting flowers, you'll be getting texts, there'll be constant, you know, conversation going on, how wonderful you are and everything else. You'll feel like you've been put on this pedestal, but in fact, you're not standing on a pedestal, you are glued to a pedestal. You are glued there, and you suddenly realize, no, you become addicted to this overwhelming attention. So when they start to do something which is called gaslighting, and gaslighting comes from the 1944 film of the same name, Gaslight, which is about a husband who made his wife feel like she was losing her mind so she wouldn't recognize his criminal activities. It's a brief summary of a film, isn't it? So that's where the phrase comes from. But what it is where they actually make you feel like you are losing your mind. So the conversation, the talk, the chatter, the text and everything else are still how much they love you, etc. But the behavior will be completely the opposite. So it's the sort of, I want to be with you, but not making any effort to actually be with you. And it puts you off balance because you've had all this overwhelming love bombing, and then suddenly it's ripped from under you, and you feel like it was something you said on earlier on as well. It's the hope that you're going to get that back that kind of keeps you, and that's the carrot that keeps you moving forward with it. And the constant, you know, it's all going to change, you know, I'm just going through this at this moment. The gaslighting can go much further, to the point where you feel like you're literally losing your mind. Can't think of it off the top of my head, but in the psychopath, they go through the actual language techniques they use. You know, where they'll
denial of things that have actually happened and conversations that happened, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Almost like Girl on the Train, doesn't it? Have you seen Girl on the Train?
Yes. Yeah. Brilliant movie. Again, we'll not ruin the ending for people, but there's, you know, sort of like if you I apologize profusely to anybody who is a fan of this person. I am not. I don't know many people in Scotland who are, but Donald Trump is a...
You're safe.
Quite careful with all that. I would describe him as a malignant narcissist. But, you know, he is an absolutely beautiful example of how he uses language to manipulate people. So, for instance, when you have a psychopath or a malignant narcissist or narcissist who is actually trying to get you to believe something that you wouldn't normally believe. So when, for instance, I found the wedding ring on the bed, the language that was used and the conversation that was used to hook me back in and get me back on side. And one of the ways they do it is called word salad. And you'll have heard Donald Trump doing it. He says absolutely nothing. He goes around about and goes back and forth. And, you know, he has great people and it's wonderful. And by the end of the conversation, you actually start putting in the answer that you would accept because you're so frustrated that the answer was exactly what I was doing just there. Word salad. It means nothing. It goes nowhere. It does nothing. And eventually you turn around and go, so, you know, it's somebody else's ring. You come up with some reason because the whole time you're sitting there, you're thinking, what actual answer would I accept? Hmm. Where is he going with this?
Going round about the houses, but yeah, not actually giving you a succinct answer. It's just to kind of distract and confuse you, isn't it?
Yes.
Seeing a lot while seeing very little.
Yes, and that's why Donald Trump's fans in America think he's a genius, because he's always giving them exactly the answer that they want, every single one of them, regardless of what that answer is.
It's a bit actually like what people who write horoscopes do.
Yes.
Right.
You can apply it to the situation however you want. It's vague enough and specific enough at the same time that you can identify with it and make it what you want to make it. Yeah. I've always found horoscopes really interesting for that purpose. Yeah. I've always liked reading them because I read every single one and I identify with them all, and that's how it works.
Yeah. So true. Yeah.
That is true. And you think, oh, maybe it'll be June.
I think I'll be Scorpio today.
Yeah, exactly. That's interesting. Actually, I had a couple of things I wanted to say, and also a couple of questions for you, Mick, things that were bothering me after reading the book. First thing I wanted to say was actually, Emma, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but you're the advert that you wrote for the dating website, I thought was so articulate and eloquent and well written. I thought it was just, I read it and I thought, I bet your inbox must have been flooded with people, because it was so just well written.
It was very attractive.
It was, wasn't it?
And I feel like, irritatingly, he's probably gone, ooh, not an easy victim then. Do you know what I mean? I feel like he's gone, oh, this isn't an easy, you know, an easy kill for me. Like, I'll need to work hard in this one.
They don't want an easy kill. Yeah. They want to be done.
Exactly what I thought. When I read it, I thought, then when I thought back on it, I thought, he's read this and went, this sounds like a challenge. Definitely.
Yeah. And also, no one's ever said that to me before, by the way. No one has ever said that it was nicely written. So thank you.
Yeah. Oh, no, we both thought that.
Yeah, definitely.
And we'd have dated you.
I would have messaged you. Also, one of the things I wanted to ask you was, so the disappointments at the beginning of the relationship, do you then think that he was testing your boundaries then to see what you would and wouldn't? Yeah.
Yes, 100%. So I mean, the very beginning, even before I met him, he had said he was going to phone me. So we talked online for however many days, a couple of weeks or something. And then he said, oh, should we call? And I said, yes. So I gave him my number and he didn't call. And I sat waiting and, you know, sort of like the time came and it passed. And I sort of like thought, I checked my phone was not out of range and it was plugged in. And it was all sorts of, you know, I mean, everything went through. It's like, why would he say that he wanted to call and then not? And then, you know, I went through the full range of annoyance and fury and worry. I started to worry that he'd actually fallen down the stairs and hurt himself or something. And he disappeared for about 2 or 3 days or something.
That would have solved a lot of your problems if he had fallen down the stairs, to be fair.
Wouldn't it? But and then, you know, when he reappeared,
Yeah, very short book.
Right. But when he did reappear, I was absolutely furious, and I told him to get lost. And it's like, under no circumstances was I interested. And you know, he was like, but I you know, it's a really, you know, I was called away to work, and I had to do this, and you know, I really, really do want to talk to you. And it was. I mean, from the very beginning, before I met him, that was gaslighting. You know, that was sort of like, you know, why would anyone do that? I mean, that's what really, I mean, that's a red flag to anybody else who ever gets that. You know, it didn't make any sense. If he really wasn't interested, then he wouldn't have come back and said that he did want to talk.
I would have done the same, though. I think I would have given him that initial second chance, because I would have gone, do you know what? Things happen to everyone. Like, it's life.
I'm being too harsh. I'm being, yeah, absolutely.
I think some of the other things, because I probably might not have been in such a vulnerable situation, I feel like it sounds like he definitely found women who were super, super bright, super empathic, but actually did have a vulnerability to them as well. And he just totally exploited that. But the problem is, because you were all so intelligent, you were second guessing yourselves constantly. And it's just so difficult to read, because, and I know you'll get this constantly, but you're reading it going, no, you can't accept that. Come on now. There's no way she's going to punt him now. That's it. She's going to punt him surely at this point. And you're like, come on, Mary, come on. I'm rooting for you here.
I've had people say that literally they've been screaming no at the book. My brother said it's rather like watching a train crash in slow motion. You know, like it's appalling, but you can't tear your eyes away.
That's it. You know, it's all well and good, though, reading it from a comfortable space and looking back in it with hindsight, but we know that is just not how it works when you're in it.
Yeah, it's a drip feed. And I mean, one of the things I did with the book, well, two reasons I did it, right? I've got a friend called John Ronson who actually wrote the book called The Psychopath Test, and he and I did a live show called The Psychopath Night, which was absolutely brilliant. It was sold out to audiences of like 2,000 every night. I mean, the things I've managed to do because of this. But one of the things he always says is me calling The Bigamist, me calling my book The Bigamist was rather like calling The Sixth Sense He's Dead. You know, what's happening. But actually, I really, if I'd written the story chronologically, nobody would have touched it. They would have thought, oh, this is a weird love story. And then, yes, there would have been a twist in the end, but, you know, who would have bought it?
Yeah.
So it wouldn't have been the right audience to buy it either. Whereas I actually wanted people to know from the very beginning, this is a con, because I wanted them to understand how people get sucked into it. You know, so, the very first chapter is actually the phone call I got from the other wife. When people buy the book and they think it's about a bigamist, I think that's the red herring, is they actually think the worst thing he does is a bigamy. Yeah. They don't realise
they get a lot more than they bargain for.
Spiral it is.
The opening to the book was perfect. I mean, straight from the off. I don't know if I said this already, Mary, but I read the book in 7 hours. Cover to cover. I didn't put it down. I just couldn't. I was absolutely... And it's been a long time since I've read a book that I just could not put down like that. It was excellent. It really, really, it was so well written and fascinating, really fascinating.
Thank you.
One of the things that bothered me, and I actually wrote these questions down as I was reading the book, because there's things that bothered me and I thought, I need to find out about this stuff. So, and also, Emma, I don't know if you wondered about this as well, but one thing that really intrigued me was on the drive back from London after Les Mis.
Yeah.
His demeanour, I can't figure that out.
I have tried, we have, between me and the other victims, we have put together a kind of timeline of what was going on, who was with him when. He averages about 5 or 6 women at once. So there's, you know, but we actually have a Facebook group of the victims now, a private Facebook group. People can't join it. We have had people ask, you know, but it's all just the victims. And so we've actually put together a timeline of where we know he was when. And that's a gap. We know there's other victims that have never come forward. Maybe they don't want to. Maybe they don't know. I mean, this is one thing that'll astound you. There was actually, I did a, he was deported in 2009. He was deported straight from jail, which gives people a little bit of giveaway what happens. But he was deported straight from jail to the USA. And since 2009, I've been getting new contacts, new victims coming forward, talking to me and everything else. And I, it's a really amazing community of women, you know, and business people and landlords, etc., who are all his victims. But the ones in America have been really quite fantastic. When he was in America, I got new victims contacted me, and me and one of the victims did a show called NBC Dateline. And whilst NBC Dateline was airing, a nurse was getting changed and ready for work, right? And she'd been given a second shift. So she'd had a shower, got changed, sat down, and she sat on the remote control of the TV, and it changed the channel from what it was on to NBC Dateline. And there on the TV screen was the man that she'd lived with for 2 years in America. The man that she had known very well. I mean, her story is far darker than this, but, you know, as detailed in The Psychopath. But and he'd just gone out one day and never come back. And she thought that he committed suicide somewhere. And there, you know, sort of like 3 years later, you know, he's on NBC Dateline. And, you know, there are so many people out there, I wonder, they just don't know. There's at the trial, at his sentencing, a woman came up to me and gave me a telephone number, and she had a son by him. We now know, when I wrote The Bigamist, I knew of 10 children by, I think it was 5 different women. I now know of 14 by 8 different women. And the youngest was born on the 1st of August 2019 to a 19-year-old girl. So, and she's now one of the Facebook group, and her little boy is my children's little brother, and, you know, they FaceTime each other and are watching this baby grow up. So
do you have a rough estimate of how many victims you may have had, just of that you know of?
I reckon, well, I know of 14 children. And the 14 children, every single one of them, bar the 19-year-old had the baby last year, have older siblings. So those siblings as well are victims. The mothers are victims. You've got the landlords. I know of 6-7 landlords that he's conned out of money. I know of probably a similar number of businesses that he's conned out of money. I reckon the amount that I know of is like an iceberg. So the 14 children that I know of will be the tip of the iceberg. I reckon there's probably more like 40. The man is, as I say, averages 5 or 6 women at once, and he actively tries to get them pregnant because you're more likely to be accommodating of father, your child, and forgive him, and, you know, than you are of a boyfriend, and less likely to kick him out. And secondly, you're tied to them for life. You know, he's got the excuse that he wants to see his child.
Although you're vulnerable as well. You're vulnerable while you're pregnant. You're vulnerable while you're looking after a child.
Therefore more malleable. So, but yeah, if you have no emotional connection even to your own children, they're just tools, they're just means into an end.
Absolutely. Mary, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but I know that the not drinking alcohol or barely drinking alcohol, to me, I don't know if you guys agree with this, but to me, it's a bit of a red flag.
Scotland, it's always a red flag if someone doesn't drink. Don't get away with it. You go out and you say, no, I don't want to drink. No. You go, I'm driving. They go, oh, okay.
just one. Because this was a thing that I found with my ex as well, and his mum was the same. She told me that she'd never been drunk once in her life.
What a shame.
But she was very much like him. They were two peas in a pod, absolutely. And he was very, very similar. And I thought, to me, it's that can't stand that thought of being out of control. You know, if you're really drunk and, you know, you say things that you shouldn't say, and, you know, you do things that are silly. And I wondered if it was similar with your ex, this whole...
No, he used to drink, but... We would open a bottle of bubbly usually when he was home, which was a celebration when he actually finally did arrive. And, you know, we would have a few glasses of wine. Interesting enough, there was a few occasions where I obviously had so much wine that I didn't remember the next day what had happened, which has never happened to me before or since. interestingly. And actually, the myself and the other wife and a couple of the victims think he actually uses roofies, which is not what you expect your husband to do to you. So, you know, you wake up in the morning and you get told something's happened and you go, really? I don't really remember that. It's all a bit of a haze. You know,
completely out of character for yourself to do, yeah. That kind of thing. Yeah.
But never crossed my mind. I mean, the things that don't cross your mind that they do, I mean, it's not to do with alcohol, but just reminded me of this story. There was one instance where my sister had been, based in Japan, speaks fluent Japanese and everything else. And he had mentioned to me early in our relationship that he'd lived in Japan for 2 years and spoke fluent Japanese. I think possibly before he knew my sister dad. So every time my sister was home, he miraculously vanished. And then one time, I don't think I told him that she was there. And we went for lunch at my parents and she was there. And she had decided she was going to test his skill and see whether or not he was telling the truth. And she asked him a very simple question in Japanese that would have been more than a yes or no answer. And she didn't get an answer, but it never crossed her mind it was a problem. Because, and we only worked this out later, and I think after I wrote The Bigamist, but actually when she asked the question, suddenly our baby's high chair, Ailey's high chair, fell over. And the thing was, the high chair had legs that were splayed very carefully. And the only way, you know, I thought she must have managed to get her foot on the chair, on the table, and push herself off. But of course, now knowing what I know, I realize he actually kicked over his own daughter's high chair when she was 9 months old to avoid answering the question in Japanese. Just gives you an idea of how far these people, and you just don't, you know, as somebody who's empathic, it doesn't even compute that would cross your mind. And he must have actually, when he walked in the room and saw that my sister was there, he must have actually strategically placed himself so that he could do it. I mean, he planned it. Mm-hmm. So that when she asked the question, he could do it.
That is horrific. And it's
like, you know, it makes you wonder.
Yeah, I was quite amazed about the fact that he could speak all these languages and play instruments and things like that. I found it really interesting. Yes. And I wondered where that all came from as well.
Oh, you can't though. You know, sort of like I was talking to his real wife, and I said, you know, but he could play the piano so well. He said, no, he can't. He can't play the piano at all. He can only play the first few bars of about 5 different pieces.
Right.
And that's what it is. It's all bluff and bluster. It's all a con. But he used to tell me that he couldn't drink. You know, he would get drunk very easily and very quickly. And then when he got drunk, he got lippy and he started to give away CIA secrets, you know, and my brother got him absolutely stocious. I mean, he was so drunk. He was actually green and puking all night at my brother's house because he got so drunk. But he started telling who killed JFK. And, you know, he started saying all this, you know, jazz. And, you know, he drank. But, I mean, he liked that challenge of keeping it going when he, you know, so he liked living on the edge and then pulling it back again and then, you know, pushing things and pulling it back again, you know, to see how far he could actually do it. But, I mean, that night he convinced my brother that he was genuine and real because my brother didn't think anyone could actually be that drunk and not stick to their story, you know. So.
Yeah, I did. I remember reading that in the book and being like, that did surprise me.
Yeah.
That part in the book. One thing that Emma, I know that we definitely did discuss this because I remember we were both baffled over this. The trench foot.
Oh.
How did that happen? Have you worked it out?
These are the questions that are answered in The Psychopath.
Excellent.
Yes, we know exactly how that happened.
Right.
He was actually in Manchester with his other wife and he was wearing a pair of boots two sizes too small for him for 2 weeks before he came home.
To give himself an alibi?
Yes, to mangle his feet.
Do you know what? Alibi. I hope it hurt every moment of those 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It will have been agonising.
Good.
Agonising.
Good.
But, I mean, psychopaths don't have an emotional response to the pain. So they feel the pain, but they just don't care about it. So yeah, it's not the same as when somebody who's empathic feels pain because you actually feel distress. And especially if you actually really fascinating, some of the experiments they've done on psychopaths. And one of them is that they've strapped one to an electric chair. So they strap a normal person to an electric chair and a psychopath to an electric chair. And they're not going to kill them. They're going to get electric shocks. But they say to the normal person, neurotypical person, they say, we're going to give you electric shock. And the heart rate starts to go up. And then they give this shock and it shoots up and then it comes down to resting again. And they go, all right, okay, fine. They say to that person they're going to give a shock again. It shoots up again before they get the shock because they anticipate the pain that they're going to get, right? Because we as empathic people empathize with our future selves the same way we do as with someone else. So, you know, when you think about it, sometimes if you are having a drink, you might go, I'll stop here because I don't want to have a hangover tomorrow. You are sympathizing with that person tomorrow. You're looking after them, right? Psychopaths, on the other hand, don't care about their future self any more than they care about other people. So the fact is, they're sitting there and they're strapped to the electric chair, and they say, we're going to give you an electric shock. And the psychopath's heartbeat is just normal. They're given the electric shock. It shoots up because they get that, but then it goes back to normal. And they say, we're going to give you another electric shock. And it stays normal until they get the electric shock because they don't care about their future self.
Insane.
So he could do damage to himself, feel the pain in the moment, but not worry about the fact he was going to carry on feeling that pain. And to give you an example, and this is the one that most women can really feel this story. This is where it gets the men, right? His partner said she was going to have her tubes tied because she didn't want to have any more children. So he said, don't do that, darling. I'll have a vasectomy. Right. Much less invasive. So he went off, had the operation and came back with what looked like two cigarette burns either side of his testes.
Oh, my God.
Strangely enough, she got pregnant again.
Did he even smoke?
No.
Do you think he actually dithered over like what brand to buy? It's like, sorry, yeah, no, I'm actually looking for these to burn myself in my testicles. Could you recommend a brand for me? And Kings, Super Kings? Is that the right one?
I love that was your question, Emma.
Sorry, Joanna's the sensible one in this relationship, I'm afraid.
Men wouldn't do it once. It's the fact that he did it twice. He knew how much it hurt. But the second before he did it, he didn't care that his future self a second time was going to feel the pain again.
Wow. That's...
And it's like, that's what, you know, we as empathic people, it's really hard to actually get a grip on quite how devoid of emotion these people can be.
It would probably be quite interesting for people if they're wanting to read your book to also read The Psychopath Test. John Ronson's book, I think they'd be quite good alongside each other. But yeah.
John and I have come to agree to disagree because he went slightly manic psychopath spotting and then has kind of pulled himself back again and said, you know, so he can't, because he's so far on the empath scale that he suffers from such severe anxiety, you know, his amygdala is firing the entire time. You know, it's quite difficult for him to appreciate that there really are people that have nothing. So he's kind of come back a little bit on the psychopath thing. But when he wrote the book, it was, you know, he was quite into the psychopath spotting.
Yeah. Is he releasing other things? Is he going to be?
Is he releasing other things? Did you say?
Yeah, is he going to release other books?
He's working on one now. He's in lockdown, but I think he's rather enjoying being locked down.
It's probably calmed down a bit.
I think, you know, so like he was saying that people in lockdown, you know, people who suffer from anxiety and introverts, you know, sort of like are uniquely prepared for world disasters, you know, because they're already there, you know.
Yeah.
So the fact that everybody else is worrying makes them feel more secure, you know.
Yeah. How are you coping with lockdown? How have you found it?
I work from home anyway. So with me, it's more the fact that my children, who are now 21, 18 and 15, are constantly here. So it's like living in a student flat. The place is a tip.
You know? How do they tell, like, what do they say to their friends about the situation? I was kind of wondering that, obviously, from the point of the reader, when you read the book, it's 14 years ago and there's been a lot that's happened since then. So I was just really curious, you know, you're in school, you're sort of, where's your dad? Well, you know, just.
Well, that's pretty much what they do, actually. They should go, well, my dad's a psychopath. And they quite cheerfully tell them the entire story. You know, that there's no... One of the things I said to them when they were really young is I said, you know, if your dad was blind, you wouldn't blame yourself that he can't see you. You know, and he is a psychopath, which means he has no empathy, no love, no compassion, you know, no guilt, no remorse. I didn't go, he's a psychopath. Mm-hmm. I just said, no, this is what he is. He has a personality disorder, which means he doesn't have the capacity to love. So it's nothing to do with you that he can't love you. So they grew up knowing that, you know, he'd done wrong, that he wasn't part of our family, but it wasn't, you know, it was something that they had to worry about. It wasn't one of the things I would always say, if the father of your children is any kind of criminal or monster or just damaged, is you never put them down. And I know that sounds strange because I've written an entire book about this guy and outed him worldwide, but I don't say, oh, he's a bastard, you know, he's a horrible guy. You know, I've just said, no, as far as I'm aware, he's a psychopath and this means this. No. Mm-hmm. So I've not been bitter and twisted about it. I've not been angry about it. And as a result, they've grown up not being angry about it and being quite secure. And it actually, as a matter of fact, when they were young teenagers, particularly the girls, and all our friends were coming, drama, oh, boyfriends, oh, this, you know. And my kids were going, I've been through worse. You know, that's one of the things that people say, you know, that I was unlucky or anything else. I actually feel that I've been very, very lucky because I have had the opportunity to show my children a golden opportunity to show them how to deal with adversity.
Emma, did you have any other questions?
I don't think so. I think we covered everything. I think it was just, I was just really interested to hear your side of things and just to have a chat with you because you get a feel for someone when you're reading a book.
Yeah.
And I just felt like you were going to be super interesting and you have been.
Absolutely.
It's an amazing story. I'm really looking forward to reading The Psychopath.
I think,
yeah, I can't wait to find out little bits of information that have come out because it's like the gift that keeps on giving.
Oh, I hope so. I like most authors and like most empaths, I suffer from imposter syndrome, which I am really trying to overcome because it's pointless, you know, sort of like, but it's that whole thing of our lovely Scottish fear of arrogance, you know, we don't want to come across like Americans.
Yeah,
we're kind of like the opposite, aren't we?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's I sent the book to a friend of mine, Marcel Theroux, and John Ronson, and they both read it, and they both were incredibly flattering about it. So I'm sort of feeling slightly more confident about The Psychopath now. But I'm always amazed that people that like The Bigamist as well. I mean, I don't know why. It's that kind of imposter syndrome thing. But I was once in a supermarket in Sainsbury's down at Cameron Toll. And I was walking around and this person came up to me and went, "You're Mary Turner Thompson." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "You kept me up all last night." And I just thought, like, and it just kind of went, oh, you know, fist bump, you know, that was great. Yeah. It's such a, it's the best compliment you can give an author is that you couldn't put the book down. So I think, you know, so thank you for saying that. It was kind of you, but you know, it's just, I think it's a compelling story.
Can you give our listeners a little, not preview, but give us a little hint of The Psychopath, what we're going to be looking to read and when it comes out, just a bit of info.
So The Bigamist is being relaunched in September by a new publisher. And then The Psychopath will be coming out December or very possibly like 1st of January. So December, very early January. And The Psychopath is the continuation of the story. So it's everything that I learned after The Bigamist came out. So far more detail about psychopaths, psychopathy, sociopaths, malignant narcissists. So all the research I've done on that, including language and techniques that they use. So there's much more practical information and analysis of what my ex was doing. So you can read The Psychopath as a standalone book, but you know, if you're reading it after you've read The Bigamist, it will make so much more sense of what he was doing. Also, it then details out what's happened since he was deported from jail to the USA and all the new victims, including the wonderful Michelle, who is... The problem is that I called the other wife Michelle in the first book. But there's a new lady whose real name, because that's not her real name, but there's a real lady called Michelle, whose real name is Michelle, in America, who is a new victim, who is, she's like my soulmate. She and I, on either side of the pond, are this bridge that makes sure every time Will Jordan comes up to court for another thing, we activate our network of new victims. So I have an ally. I have a compatriot, and, you know, very similar to me, but in America. And her story and some of the other victim stories as well from America. So there's more to come. And the thing is that it will never end. It's like somebody said, what's going to be the third book? And I said, well, it's going to have to be something, you know, but the first one's the bigamist, the second one's a psychopath, the third one has to be the predator, doesn't it? So, yeah. Or something, you know, it's got to, you know. So it would be interesting to see what happens.
Will you come back and talk to us?
Of course. I'd love to, actually. Yeah. I really enjoyed the conversation.
That would be really nice. Mary, I had one final question for you, and it is my most important question, actually. My biggest question, the thing that I really wanted to know the most after reading the book, I wanted to ask you, how are you now?
I am absolutely fabulous.
Excellent. It does seem like you are, but I wanted to find out that you were okay, and that you know, that there was a lot of positives that came out of this horrible thing for you, and that, you know, your life is better than it ever could have been.
It is better than it ever could have been. I am absolutely wonderful. I mean, even in lockdown, I have my three children with me, who are great fun, who I admire and love and enjoy. We've actually been getting on really well. You know, I'm now sitting in the house that I own. Again, I am running a company called Whitewater Publishing, where I publish books by children for children. So I get to run workshops in schools, not in lockdown, but that will happen again. You know, I'm getting to write books. I'm getting to travel and do shows with John Ronson. I'm getting to do the Edinburgh Book Festival when it's on, and hobnob with other authors. And, you know, I'm doing amazing things because of this, you know. And it's like somebody once said, you know, you can either, if you get knocked back, you can either just carry on falling until you fall on the ground, or you can consider it like pulling the bow of an arrow. You pull the bow and you allow it to shoot you forward. And it's like, I think when I wrote The Bigamist, I had climbed out of a hole. Mm. When I wrote The Psychopath, I climbed a mountain. Aww. And, you know, and that's where I am now. And I'm on top of a mountain looking down the world, and I'm very happy, really enjoying myself. And, you know, yeah.
That's so inspiring, honestly. Yeah, it really is.
That is. I'm very much looking forward to The Psychopath, and the Bigamist was an excellent book. It was really well written. As I say, I couldn't put it down. I would recommend it over and over, and I'm sure it's something that our listeners would be interested in reading. And I just want to say thank you so much for coming and speaking to us tonight. It has been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a pleasure talking to you too. I really enjoyed it, actually.